So it's after 12 on a Sunday, and sometimes we like to get a little bit philosophical, a little bit reflective at this time. So let's all now take a deep breath and calm down, and let's have a chat about the collective consciousness. So Tom Inglis is a sociologist and an author, and he joins me now from Sligo. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd say that frightened most people, the
yeah,
idea of
I know, yeah, but you know what? Let's challenge them a little bit here. So, Tom, right back at the start of this, I think it was Patrick's weekend, wasn't it? As our world was falling apart, you wrote what I suppose a very prescient piece, really, which is, we will not overcome the virus unless we develop a collective consciousness. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've heard a lot since about how we're all in this together and everything. Did it happen us as a nation? Do you think the collective came through?
Yes, in some ways it did. And I sometimes have a sense of hope when we talk about we, and obviously Micheál Martin and the political leaders invoke the we, I think that by and large we didn't fall apart, for example, to the extent that they seem to have done in the States. And by and large, I think that European societies have come together and weathered the storm. I sometimes despair when the we is invoked too much. I sometimes think we suffer from a we problem. And by that I mean that there's a lot of people excluded from the we. Older people obviously don't know how to look after themselves, and they have to be told what to do. And then young people are kind of portrayed, and we talk about them as different. So this we that, to which we belong seems to me sometimes that it's a middle-class, middle-aged phenomenon. So the question then is, to what extent and what did we do differently? Well, for me, the main one that normally collective consciousness comes together through religion. And from the time that humans stopped being hunter and gatherers and they started into farming, religion grew up as a means of binding people together.
So this was a common story, basically, that we could all buy into, was it?
Yeah, so religion basically for me does two things. One is it provides an explanation of life and how we came to be the way we are. And it also provides a way to live a good life. And that's a fundamental kind of characteristic of all world religions.
So and that, the way then, that binds us together then, does it? Makes us feel part of a collective rather than feeling too much like we're in it on our own.
Yes, and that collective consciousness is generally maintained or created and maintained through rituals. So the coming together produces a form of bonding and belonging. And it's not based on reason or rationality. It's just human beings coming together and expressing themselves, and more importantly, losing themselves. And they lose themselves in the worshipping of a god. But in reality, of course, is that they are worshipping each other. They're worshipping the community. The question then is...
Would that be a sense, just for people who don't have religion then, would that be a similar sense to like when you lose yourself, say, in a crowd at a football match or at a gig or whatever, you do kind of give yourself up to the collective, don't you? And like, you know, when a crowd rises as one at an exciting part of a match or whatever, there almost is a sense that people have lost their individuality in it, isn't there?
Well, that's it. And it's a form of ecstasy. I mean, ecstasy is ecstatic, and it's. But what has happened is that you lose yourself. But the thing about those football matches or other collective gatherings, that collective consciousness is just momentary. It's a kind of an emotional mood, and when people go out of the football stadium, they go back to being individuals. So, but if a collective consciousness if you like, lasts beyond the actual the gathering, it becomes a collective conscience.
So with religion kind of not as prevalent as it once was, what are the things that hold us together now as a nation, or make us feel part of each other and part of the whole?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I suspect and I hope that it is that we are part of a cohesive, cohere, mature democratic society in which we can, you know, talk and reason things out, and that we're not bound by some unquestioned, taken for granted beliefs, and that's one of the, you know, one of the great things in a way that sustained, I can't say it's a great thing, but one of the things that sustained these religious communities or kinship groups was that there were traditions, there were rituals. And like, you know, the Catholic Ireland I grew up in, there wasn't much time for reasoned debate and discussion. I mean, if I said, I say to my mother, I think I'll go, my mother would say, who are you to be thinking? And there was that surrender to, you know, the family, to the community, to the church.
Okay, and, so and we actually, that is in the kind of, it's in our DNA a bit in Ireland, is it, to be more of the collective, yes?
I think, and I go back to an earlier conversation as to, you know, about why the pub is so important in Ireland. Unfortunately, the pub became a place where there was this collective consciousness. It was a almost a sacred space, but that's where people lost, if you like, themselves to the wider group. And sometimes that wider group could be, as we know, a hard drinking, male group, and it wasn't. But there were, you know, when women were included, and it's become that space where people lose themselves. And I think that what makes the Irish different is their willingness to let go of themselves.
Tom, there's a texter here says the modern creator of the collective consciousness is Facebook and the likes.
Well, that is absolutely the case, but the question is that doesn't create a collective consciousness. Facebook is a wonderful space, but it can also be a space of individual nightmares. You can be liked or disliked. But you don't get that sense of being in a community. Now, I say,
yeah,
somebody,
I think sometimes people do, in fairness, and when it's all going well. Listen, in terms of how we behaved as a collective in this, it's interesting what you said about, like, that the we could be exclusive at times, because. Yeah. People would say that there was a lot of, in order for people to come together, they came together in busybody, finger pointing, yep. othering, as you said, young people, old people. There was a lot of blame and shame going around as well. I presume is that a bad aspect of the collective?
I think all collectives need a scapegoat.
Okay.
And what it is like... there is a sense of moral superiority. You know, we are the ones who do the right things, and we are responsible, and we're good people. And then there are those people who are not so good, and we want to blame them. When it's the young are and sometimes the people turn on who the supposedly good people. I think that's what the venting of the anger about Golfgate and indeed about RTE, is that there is this hoi polloi, one rule for us, one rule for them. And
so that people who set themselves up above other people.
And exactly. And that's why I'm very cautious of when we say we, to be mindful that a lot of people, when we say we, say, oh, well, I'm not one of them. I mean, I don't want to be one of them. I don't want the state. I don't want Neffet telling me what to do and what not to do. That's the system.
But then presumably, equally, the collective is not just a kind of a, it's not a universal consciousness either that decides things the way, I don't know, the way like a colony of ants would or something. Does the human collective need leadership? Like, just looking there at that poll in the yep. mail that we were talking about earlier, and people rating leaders, and they rated political leaders, and then out there ahead of them all at 6.7 or whatever out of 10 is Tony Houlihan.
Yep.
Do people look to people like that at a time like this, the collective?
Well, yes, again, charismatic leaders. And Tony Houlihan has a lot of charm. I'm not sure he's a charismatic leader. But yes, strong leadership is you know, again, central to most religions, is that there have been you know, figures, gurus, prophets that have you know, brought us into the promised land and guided us.
I think it would be fair to say that Tony Houlihan did become somewhat of a guru and a prophet, and like he was the one who was going to guide us out of this. I think, would you not think the collective put a lot of faith in him?
I agree, but it's I think it's different from somebody like Gandhi. He's a scientist, and it's you know, his message is one based on scientific rationale. Yes,
which has almost, though, Tom, become a religion for people, hasn't it? And now we have our saviors in the form of, science has delivered our saviors, or will do, in the form of the vaccines.
But the problem with scientists, and this has come up with in the debate, is that they don't do meaning. And for me, okay. what the big thing that's happening at the moment, and was on the earlier part of the program, is that, you know, whatever else human beings have done, is that in the middle of winter, in the darkest days, they have come together as pagans, as Christians. And the whole thing is that this is about bonding and belonging, about coming together. And it's almost, it's kind of a bodily thing as much as a mental thing.
To come and huddle, basically.
Come and huddle and regenerate. And so then
you think we really need Christmas in one way? We need that ritual for well-being,
and that's what we're trying to do. And that's what, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, what rituals have we? We're in this thing of whereby we're going to have to create new rituals. So yes, we've become very good at Skyping and Zooming, but they've left out a lot of people. And if people don't get that sense of regeneration, if they don't get that sense of bonding and belonging, we know what the mental health, you know, consequences of that. But it's not even at a mental health level. It's about, if you like, when I was growing up, you talk about the soul. But there is that sense of spiritual well-being that comes, that generates from being together.
And belonging.
Yes. And we know it is that there is a difference from, you know, even talking to you at a distance than being in your company. I'm not even, the last time I was on, I was talking, I could see your eyes, I could respond to your gestures. And that's why that, you know, and that's even just face contact. Mm. But the, you know, the sensation that the endorphins that are released by hugging the ones we love is enormous.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is that we have survived through Zoom, through technology. But I think hopefully it'll be a once-off experience which we'll remember. But I think we were talking earlier, you know, we have to reinvent these rituals. And a lot of the earlier discussions on the program, you know, what are you going to do this Christmas? You know, how can you create that meaning? How can you create that sense of bonding and belonging without actually physically hugging, without actually being in the same space over a period of time? So, you would go right back to the beginning. You said, have we been successful at it? By and large, yes. And if you think that the only breakdown has been, you know, young people, I don't know how old they are, but, you know, gathering in Galway or Killarney or South William Street. That's quite incredible achievement, and particularly by young people. I mean, my goodness, whatever about me. I mean, I'm you know, isolated and you know, kind of thriving in a way. But I mean, like, to have that, you know, cut off from that that whole socialization of bonding and belonging, of, you know, dating, getting the shift or whatever it is. I mean, that's enormous. And I think, you know, to talk about young people or to talk about old people, that they are not part of the we, they are a problem. You know, we just got to be very careful.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't invoke the we so often, so readily.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Listen, it felt, so I started doing this show around the time that the pandemic started, and it would feel, it felt coming in here and looking at the texts and the emails every week during that very bleak period, that there was a collective mood almost, and you could almost smell it or taste it from you know, that there was a huge commonality and a sense that people were in it together and all those cliches, right? And then I think it has probably felt in the last few months, if you use that screen as a gauge, that there's been a splintering of that collective mood and collective will. Would you say, is that something you think is true?
I think it is, and I think the lockdown initially was novel, and I think there was also a huge fear. And, you know, the fear factor bound people together. And then once, if you like, the information started to come through, and once, if you like, the realization of how this virus works, and it was, in a way, that information that broke down the fear and gave people leeway, you know, to take chances, to engage in risk behavior. And I think that's one of the main problems when we're now coming into Christmas, is everybody's saying, Asher, the vaccine's on its way. No problem. Off we go. I don't know. I mean,
so the collective story that we're telling ourselves here is changing, is what you're saying.
It is evolving, if you like, by the day. And I'm glad I'm not a minister, because, you know, making these decisions, because, you know, talk about the nanny state, but that, you know, trying to regulate the we, and trying to engender that sense of, you know, personal responsibility, collective responsibility. At the same time, when there is this, you know, desperate need to bond and belong.
That's the problem with that bloody we, Tom. It has a mind of its own. Listen, do you see this, from with your sociologist hat on, do you see this changing us as people, as a society, or will it be like an elastic band, we'll just snap back afterwards and go back to the way we were?
Well, the COVID is one example of how we need this collective consciousness, but we need it desperately in relation to the environment. I mean, you know, that story of the, you know, the cave and the daddy long legs coming together to fool the bats, because they all hung out at the side of this cave wall, and the bats flew by them because they were all bound together as one pulsating organism. Okay, but the idea that human beings can go on destroying the planet without this collective consciousness, I have no idea. I don't think we're going to go back to the type of religion that we had in the past, which is unquestioning male patriarchal types of religion. But it's very difficult to know how we can create a sense of belonging and being in nature, and not destroying it, and not seeing it, you know, that, you know, we have a right to indulge ourselves. And to fill our needs and interests, and not be responsible for other species, and it's all about us.
So you think that consciousness could become more in tune with Gaia and all that kind of thing? And indeed, we'll be talking to a remarkable young man in a few minutes, who's very, very immersed in the natural world. Before you go, Tom, the last time you were here, you were talking about your a book you'd written about your dog and the death of your dog and everything.
Mm.
So I almost feel like getting a dog. I have to get a dog myself at this stage. Like everyone I meet has suddenly got a dog.
Yep.
And everywhere I go walking, everyone, the dogs everywhere, and it's become a real thing, hasn't it? People have turned to dogs.
Well, and as we were talking about the last time I was on, to love a dog is it's okay. It's a good thing to do, and there's a lot of things that have got us through COVID, but I technology obviously, but I think for an awful lot of people, their pet, in my case, a dog, has been a source of comfort, consolation, inspiration. I mean, I have a new dog in my life, and it's just wonderful. I get up in the morning, even these cold, wet winter mornings down in Leitrim or Roscommon, and it's just to see her delight in the day and the excitement that comes. You're a bit late getting into the dog market. I mean, one of the great things I would hope is...
Listen to the price you'd pay for them now. There's no way I'm getting one.
Well, no, you can go along to the dog shelter I don't know whether the DSP... But the thing is, of course, and that's what the book was about, is, a dog is for life. And, when Pepe got to 17, you realise what it means as a dog is for life. Because,
and not just for lockdown?
Not just for lockdown, no
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
No.
All right, listen, Tom, that was absolutely fascinating. I hope we didn't lose people with that now, because I think it was a really interesting kind of, just a nice to look under the bonnet now and again, isn't it, Tom? Just a little bit, not too much.
My problem is I'm always looking under the bonnet.
Yeah, you see, you need to get out of Leitrim and talk to a human being instead of the dog. Tom, great to talk to you. Okay. Thanks a million, Tom Inglis. We take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.